With us today, we appreciate your presence. You're, as we've said in the past, honored guests. We hope you'll linger a little bit so we get to know you. And we are encouraged by everyone's presence here, and we hope to be an encouragement to you through the very worship that we're doing and offering up to God and through the lesson that we're offering this morning. We're going to be looking at a crisis of faith, and this is something that has a very specific and a general application. I've been told even atheists have doubts every once in a while about their faith. It's something we all go through. Whatever we believe in, there's times when we doubt it, when we, you know, when it gets tested. Sometimes we don't, you know, maintain through it. Other times we just shine. So what we're going to be looking at this morning will be some examples more for the specific of maintaining the faith we should have in God. But there's principles that are going to be offered that are applicable to anything we believe in, if it's worth maintaining. Proceeding on with this thing here, and of course the illustration has to, the illustration goes well with the closing song, if you want to keep that in mind. Let me go back for a moment. That little kind of reminds you of Peter on the water, you know, when it starts getting choppy and he's got a little faith to begin with, but loses it. Hebrews 10:38, God says, "My righteous one shall live by faith. If he shrinks back, my soul has no pleasure in him." So we're going to be looking at little storms of life and how to overcome them and maintain our faith through them. Faith is always in crisis. It is true that there are joys to faith. I mean, don't forget all this. There's joys to faith. There's benefits to faith. There's edification in faith. I mean, there's a lot of things that come out of the things we believe in, especially when we believe in God, that he rewards us for, you know, what we hold to. And therefore, the rewards of faith. But also, it is true that faith is always in crisis. It's always being tested, especially if we let it. And this is one of the problems we have to be aware of. You know, as we go daily through it, sometimes what's occurring is so subliminal, and then it just kind of wells up. You know, as you see a calm sea, you think there's nothing wrong, and then suddenly the storms come up, and you're in a danger area. So not every day brings a crisis. We don't live in a constant state of emergency, but the quality of faith is such that is always under attack. On a calm sea, your faith, if you let it, can be shattered. I mean, just the fact that if there's nothing else around you and there's horizons that extend on forever, even though it's calm, you get this kind of sense of loneliness, of abandonment, you know, if you let it. Or you can pray to God and develop that companionship, and then you're never alone, and there's nothing that worries you. And if you think that, you know, far horizons don't bother people, they say roughly about, you know, half to a third of the people that set out, you know, in this country at the early part of it to head west, a lot of them, when they got to the plains, were so frightened by the horizons that they turned around and went back. You know, they're used to mountains and, you know, small little scenarios of life, and when they saw the broadness of it, it got kind of scary. Okay, so life can be that way. The carnal mind is one that has no faith, 1 Corinthians 3:11. So this is one of the benefits of what God gives us, something beyond ourselves, something that sees beyond the box we live in, that gives us something to hope and look for. You know, just the element of faith itself, you know, where trust and hope and all those are a mixture, they go into the mixture of faith. This is something that that God can give us to the maximum. You know, you can get it in other things, but everything else pretty much will fail you. You know, this is, faith in God is something that's paramount in life that'll see you through all crisis, okay? Even its own crisis of faith. It is always concerned with earthly matters, that is the carnal mind, with jobs, sports, family, and leaves God, the church, the Bible, and faith out of the picture. I mean, a lot of times, don't we feel that this is less important than the big things? You know, I got to go to work, I got to make the money, you know, I got to support the family. How much is that is going to be here when life is over? You see, you're locked in the box. You're living in a canyon. the small little skies. And it looks big to you, but once God opens up the territory, yeah, you better be ready for the vastness. Okay? In fact, you can be. You can see by faith the infinite God as he's described. He's given us, yeah, that's interesting. He's given us the capacity to see beyond what we can see. We can't imagine things. What we will do in this lesson is look at various crises of faith and how each trial and conflict was handled by the people of God. So, first of all, the life of Abraham and the role of faith. The life of Abraham is often held up in the New Testament by New Testament writers as exhibiting a kind of faith that we as Christians should have. So there's nothing different between Old Testament faith and New Testament faith. So we can get examples from both. In fact, this is what Paul does in order to really explain a lot about the concepts of Christianity and the New Covenant. He goes back to the Old. Okay, not exactly the Old Covenant, but to a person in the Old Testament. You see, the promises that are fulfilled in the New Testament were promises made to Abraham before the Mosaic Covenant. And that's important. This is what Paul is bringing out in Romans 4. Okay? And the faith that Abraham had is the kind of faith that the Christian needs to have. So, various examples, you know, the events, we'll look at them shortly, but being called out of Chaldea, okay, that was a crisis of faith. And there are, you know, psychologists recognize that there are times in our life that are crisis. Loss of loved ones, children or parents, moving, loss of job. These are things that some people can't handle at all. Okay? But a Christian, and this is the difference, too, between the Christian religion, I was just thinking about, you know, recently, that most religions just give you doctrines. Christianity is the one religion that gives you a change, that you become different. It's trying to help the fortification of your soul for all the emergencies that life is going to throw at you. And after a while, they become no big deal. And when we've done this before, if you go through 2 Corinthians, the 11th chapter, and all the things that, you know, Paul talks about, you know, that he had to endure, you know, really life-threatening experiences. I mean, it's one after the other where he was in danger of dying. Okay. And there's one that he mentions in 2 Corinthians 3 that he said Timothy and he had just given up. They thought there was no way out of this situation. They were going to die, and they were just, you know, making themselves ready for it. And somehow, God got them through it. Okay? Things that we will not have to experience in this life. And then in chapter 4, he calls it momentary light affliction. Okay? So God is preparing us to take on things, especially the ultimate crisis of passing out of life into death and beyond. Okay? His accepting Isaac as the promised child and also having to offer up Isaac as a sacrifice. Okay, we're going to momentarily look at those. In each crisis of his life, Abraham's faith shines forth. Now, it is no wonder that his reactions to these events remain as examples to us to trust in God in the same way that we should. Notice, if Abraham had not faith, he would not have left Ur of the Chaldees. Okay, now, it takes maybe a little imagination to understand all he had to undergo here. Maybe if you can think of, if you're used to living in like Los Angeles or New York, you know, among skyscrapers and a lot of people, and all the things that you need right there at your fingertips, you know, at the market just down the street, and give up everything and go live in Uzbekistan. Never heard of it, right? I tell you, the quality of life is a lot, you know, different and less than here. But that's what he was willing to do. Now, I've gone off on excursions to weird places, but, you know, I've never having to take my whole family with me. I mean, Abraham had to take everybody with him, you know, uncles, kids, you know, whatever. I mean, they were all his responsibility. And he had to lead him on a journey to some place that he'd never been before. All because God asked him to. Would you have that kind of faith? Now, he would not have believed God and stopped trying to make Eleazar heir if he didn't have a proper faith. Okay, sometimes we just look at these and go, well, what kind of faith is it? You know, God had made promises to him, and the promises were big. They were gigantic compared to that time. I mean, we're talking about, you know, the longevity of his heirs, his descendants, you know, a family extension that goes off through generations. That was a really big idea at that time. And he is being promised that this is all going to happen through a legitimate heir. But Abraham, at this point, is in his late 90s, and Sarah's way beyond having children. And at one point, he wants to make, you know, by his bondservant a child, the promised heir. And God goes, no, wait for it. Okay. At a time when it was physically impossible for he and Sarah to have children, God is still saying, wait for it. And finally, he gets Isaac. Now, then there's the test of that. Here's this heir, finally, that's going to be a fulfillment of all the promises, not only to himself, but the blessings to all the world and all mankind. And now God says, I want you to sacrifice him to me. Could you do it? Could you take your child out on an altar and treat it like an animal and sacrifice to God? I mean, Abraham's thinking was, well, God gave him to me. Yeah, he can bring him back. He had that kind of faith, a resurrection of the dead, precursor to what God was going to have to do. Okay? This is the kind of faith Abraham had in his God. Many times we do not know or if a crisis looms. Sometimes the challenges are great, but at other times the situation seems so small that they're overlooked. You know, this is a critical thing. This is where, you know, how do you get a strong faith? How do you build up this sort of thing? And truly, Abraham didn't always have a strong faith. I mean, as you look at the characters, you know, especially in the Old Testament or even in the New, you know, what God has given us is a way to build a stronger faith. You know, it's, you know, the gospel is from faith to faith. Don't overlook that. I mean, Abraham, there's times we see in his life when challenged, man, he lied, didn't believe in God. Times when he wimped out. Well, how is that a, you know, sample of, you know, the ultimate of faith to it? Well, it gets down to this. Those little subliminal things, those small things, what makes a strong faith? The small decisions. That we don't treat anything as small. That, you know, we're going to make the decision to do the right thing. That we're not going to lie. That we're going to carry forth on something that we promised. That it doesn't matter, you know, it's just a little thing we're tested by, but we look at it as, you know, I've got to stand firm even here. These small decisions and small triumphs build up to a character that can take on the bigger ones. When we start acquiescing and backpedaling even on the smaller things, by the time we get to something big, we're going to give in because we haven't got the character that's been built up to there. This is a principle that we need to recognize. You know, that the final decisions we got to make in order to, like, to stand for God or whatever really isn't that big a decision if we've made all the right decisions up to that. I'll give an example of this. When I worked for New York Life, you know, they told us, you know, here's the good salesman. You know, as you sit down with someone, okay, and you're making your presentation, what you're doing, you can use this for, you know, you're doing evangelism too, is you have the person just make small decisions. I mean, what they're doing is slowly agreeing with you through the presentation. So So they said it shouldn't be, you know, as you come to the final commitment, it shouldn't be a whopping big thing, you know, do I have to give my firstborn son, you know, in order to have some life insurance. You know, the final decision should be, am I going to use the blue ink or the black ink in order to sign the contract? When it's a small decision, it's an easy decision. But because you've made so many agreement decisions up to that point, even maybe all of them were small, the last thing could be a commitment, but still a small decision. I mean, you can see that with Joshua. He says, I don't care. You know, you guys can go stay with the gods of Egypt, or you can stay with the gods of this land, but for me and my family, what? We're going to serve God. Why? Because we've made that decision over and over and over again, and at this point, it's not that big a deal. You know, that's just the way we are. This is the way our life has been patterned. This is why you've got to be very careful. All the little temptations, all the trials that you meet in life, make sure that you overcome each one of them. Because even the smallest is going to add a little bit to your character. Whereas everything you start giving into, even though you consider it small, it takes a little bit away from you. A little bit away from your character, it leaves you that much weaker. Look at examples. Should we watch TV or study our Bibles? I'm tired. You know, I've been studying for a while. You know, just whatever. But studying the Bible may give us the information we need to face a coming crisis that we'll be unprepared for if we don't read. I mean, a lot of times, like people get into knowledge and stuff like that because knowledge is power. How's it power? Well, it gives them an insight on how to work something that maybe somebody else doesn't have. It gives them a way of dealing with a problem that maybe somebody else doesn't know about. But because they took the time to burn the midnight oil, they came up with it. I guarantee you, the people that are here for every sermon, every class, that read their Bible every day, are stronger and more prepared Christians than those that are here just once in a while. I mean, does it ever bother you that, when you're not here, what you may have missed? You may have missed the one thing that could be the turning point of your whole life. Okay, I'm not giving myself that much credit. I'm just trying to tell you, every once in a while I get lucky and bring out something that's really a jewel in somebody's life that God has given us. You missed it. Can you really afford to do that? Or what kind of friend shall we pick? That's very critical. I've talked to someone, I forgot who it was, but we decided, as we look at our life, we jettisoned our friends early. I mean, my experience is, even as a little kid, my little friends always got me in trouble. Even when I wasn't involved, I got in trouble. So it finally dawned on me, maybe a life as a loner might be a little bit more advantageous than being, if I'm too weak to resist them, just don't be around until I get a little stronger. Be careful. It's the friends that drag you down. I've mentioned this before. I've had some very dear friends in the church, younger ones that I actually bonded with. Lost them to the world, to drugs. And where they get them from? Supposedly fellow Christians. A member of the church got him involved in drugs. Be very careful of the people you pick. In fact, what I finally decided to do is just stay with older folks. The ones that have figured life out, that are strong in the faith, whatever, just hang around them. Okay, they'll help you grow up and protect you for a while. Shall we stay home and not attend Bible study? Okay, what influence are we placing before our children then? Okay, will they be ready for their crisis if we don't build their faith? What have we shown them? Oh, well, I'm strong. I don't have to go every once in a while. Really? Okay, maybe you are, but what kind of influence are you having on somebody else? Somebody built the barriers for you and you were protected, and so, okay, your character is maybe a little stronger, but you're already starting to show signs of weakness. Because you're starting to do things that Paul warns about, they're starting to influence others. man, if you don't think that's a principle, consider some of the paintings of Norman Rockwell. Very famous one about the wife, you know, marching off to church and the kids are looking at daddy and he's sinking down under the newspaper, staying home. Abraham probably made 1,000 decisions that related to faith before the 3 tests God put before him. Okay? Each decision that led up to the critical one was part of his life of faith. The decisions that you make when you get up in the morning about your speech, your work, your worship, your influence, your friends, are all part of the impending crisis that will make or break you, not as a Christian, but as an individual. As a man or a woman, as a mature individual, you know, are you going to stand against the world or not? The life of Timothy and the role of faith, New Testament example. Although some things like common sense and wisdom cannot be taught, I mean, some people that are born clueless, they seem to stay clueless. Not a thing you can do about it. Some one comedian put it this way, you can't fix stupid. But God can help. Pray for wisdom, send it to you. But faith, that's not one of those elements. Faith can be taught. I mean, the more evidences you look at that there is a God and the Bible is His Word, the greater confidence you'll have in it. More of that study. Timothy obtained his from his mother and grandmother, 1 Timothy 1:5. You know, these two ladies sat down and they worked with him. And that's where his faith came from. Mother was, you know, let's look at it. There was a daily crisis about his training and schooling, the daily activities he had to face as a Greek youngster, and the Hellenistic concept of sports and mythology and idols. I mean, there were powerful influences back then. As to sports, I mean, there's a lot of young people now that are into sports. I mean, it draws away from the church, especially a lot of events are on Sunday. There's even more of an influence back there because you're competing, hopefully for the games and the renown and everything else. But again, you know, we've mentioned, you had to do it in the buff. That's the way the Greeks did their athletics. No clothes. There's a story that did that because they didn't want women involved. Kept them out. Okay. But you know, looking at this, the mythology, you know, when you look at Thessalonica, you know, what did they have to contend with? Hey, there's a church established at the base of Mount Olympus. Talk about the pressure of mythology. Okay, and idol worship, Athens especially. It did not change when he grew up and faced the congregations he was left in charge of, constantly encouraged by Paul to not let them despise his youth. As a young person going in among older folks. We're getting in a study of that. We encourage you to come Sunday mornings. We can see similar crisis in our own lives and the lives of our children. How much Bible will our children be taught versus secular nonsense? Now, there's some good things being taught in school. You know, we're not coming down and just every aspect of it, but there's too much also social engineering going on in school and military and everything else. About trying to get, I mean, it's an indoctrination into atheism, evolution, okay, or more liberal concepts. They're being pressured with it. How much of that are they getting versus how much, you know, concept of God are they getting at home? Remains only to say that nearly all positions on evolution, there's a quotation, okay. I put this in there for, I know a lot of kids will like the Jurassic Park movies, whatever. Okay, here's the author and director of some of them, Michael Crichton. He's a scientist. First of all, he was a medical doctor. I don't know if you know his background or not. In fact, his first book had to do with 5 operations he was involved in. And he quit being a doctor to go into, you know, the movie business and everything. Author, director, you know, he's directed a lot of movies, whatever. But this is the precursor to the second book of Jurassic Park, The Lost World. So it remains only to say that nearly all positions on evolution remain strongly contended and fiercely debated. Even though he talks about evolution, yeah, he's seriously critical of it. How many Bible classes are attended or missed? How prepared will they be, and we'll talk about the young people, when it comes to the time to choose an occupation? Choose, you know, what are you going to be? You know, are you aware that there's some occupations you may not want to go into? Bartender, you know, whatever. I tell you, even as choices narrow, because of the character that Christ can give you, opportunities will broaden. I mean, how many young people do you know because of prison record, drug record, whatever, can't get certain jobs? Can't even get in the military, which is usually the last, you know, bastion of young people that want to drop out of school. Well, I can always go in the military. What if the military doesn't take you? You know, when you start getting interested in life, maybe you want to be in law enforcement or other things that are part of the community, you know, firefighters, whatever. You find out your background of the stupid things you did as a young person, you know, keep you from doing now something you're fired up about and want to do. What about, you know, choosing a mate? I mean, we got examples from among ourselves. You know, of young people that, you know, and as I'm saying, you know, not just choosing a Christian for a mate, but choosing a good Christian. Because just because somebody shows up at church doesn't make them necessarily a good Christian. You want to have somebody with the same fire for the Lord that you do. You know, first of all, get that fire in yourself first. Then go looking for someone of like mind. Okay? Because the wrong mate will pull you into the world faster than anything else. Used to have a professor, college, and used to use the example of he used to stand on a chair. Okay, use the podium here, and just have anybody come up here and have me try to pull him up. Or reverse the process. Me standing below, you standing up here, and me grabbing your hand, and you trying to pull me up. Good luck. 6'5", 260 pounds, whatever, go for it. You're going to strain to do it. But all I have to do is just barely pull, and you're off this podium. It's a lot easier to pull somebody down than to pull them up. Physically, mentally, spiritually. So what you want is someone to go through life with that's going to be a help to you. Okay? Even the apostles had the right to be married. Peter was. But when Paul talks about himself in 1 Corinthians 9, he talks about his rights as an apostle. He says, don't I have the right to have a believing wife? He knew that the choice was limited. Not just anybody, but if you're really sincerely wanting to serve God in this life, you're going to choose your mate accordingly. You know, your partner, your life partner. Take the many turns on the road that lead to being a Christian. I mean, this is life. Decisions you make will determine which way you're going. I mean, you see that physically. And do you stay on the broad highway if you're going some places, or do you take every turn off? Depends on where you're going. But those are decisions you make. And a lot of times, those decisions will get you off the road, into a place you don't know, and your car broken down. Then what do? And a lot of people in life find themselves that way. The decisions, little decisions. We know that a crisis has been reached many times by the after effect when it's too late to do anything about it. Too late. You know, second day in the service. You know, I'm looking at myself and going, I signed up for this for 4 years? You know, couldn't believe it. It's like, I wrote home, yeah, hey, Mom, I died, and this is my, this is it. This is what I deserve. It's just, some things, this is where you are. dead ends. I've been in places where you go, man, this, worst prospects. Dead end job, going nowhere. Where do I do? What move do I make now to get out of this, this cul-de-sac? Okay. But every road, every success, every failure, it always begins with a decision. I mean, for young people especially, are you Christians because your parents make you come to services? Okay. Or have you made the grown-up decision that it doesn't matter what happens, you're going to be faithful to God no matter what? When your parents say, oh, I'm too tired to go, and you go, I don't want to hear it, and you start pulling them out of the house. When you become the adult, having to encourage your parents to do the right thing, then you know you're there. Conversely, if you're 30 years old and still living with your parents, and they're having to get you out of bed in the morning and go out and look for work or whatever, okay, you've made a lot of, Conan O'Brien, an argument with the mayor of New Jersey or something like that. And the mayor said, he can no longer fly into New Jersey. And he goes, that's fine with me. Mostly how people get to New Jersey is through a series of bad, decisions. So a lot of times you'll find yourself, you look at yourself in life and go, how did I get here? Just a series of bad decisions. Conversely, if you find yourself in heaven at the end of this, it's through a series of good decisions. Just a little bit at a time, improving your character, strengthening your character, get there. Children reach accountability with no desire to obey the gospel. How did they get that way? Sometimes you can blame the parents. Sometimes you blame the child. The child wanted to remain young, playful, didn't want to learn, didn't want to grow. I mean, I know of parents that pretty much did everything they knew how, and they wonder what happened to the child. Well, eventually, the child gets to a point where it's got to start making decisions for his own. He starts making bad decisions. Children marry a non-Christian and go with them to another faith. Children reach maturity with no interest in God. How do they get there? It doesn't happen overnight. It's just decisions they make in themselves. In many cases, it doesn't depend on the parent. There's people that, never been raised in a Christian faith, get converted to it. I mean, if you want to look at, parents, look at Josiah in the Old Testament. Probably the best king Israel ever had. Who were his parents, though? Manasseh, relatives Ahab. Man, he had the worst dysfunctional family you could come from. Growing up in the worst possible situation. But he made the decision at the age of 8 that he was going to serve God to the best of his ability. And those small decisions that he made carried him through into all of life. So that it said when he served God, God wasn't served like that until the time of Samuel. I mean, that gets rid of all the kings. So I say, probably the best king Israel ever had. Worst circumstances, best child of God. Oh, congregations in crisis of faith, crises of faith. Sometimes elders, teachers, preachers do not appreciate the need to be instructors of the Word of God. And they let classes become rap sessions or, just social gatherings. Let's talk about this. I've been to churches where it's so watered down. It's anemic. Doesn't get the job done. As we start 1 Timothy 1, you'll see that's the thing that Timothy's facing. Things that don't do the job. I mean, what God is trying to do through the gospel is save souls. You can't make it a social event. I mean, there were the meaningless genealogies, endless genealogies, myths. People are going, I think this, I think that, whatever. And it didn't get to the heart of what did Christ come to do? How were we saved? It doesn't get down to the relevance of belief, of baptism for the remission of sins, for walking in the light. Never comes down to that. It never comes down to challenging the world to build up our faith and to serve God. They talk about everything else. They become like the world. They just want to make it nice for people to be here. Well, guess what? It's not always going to be nice being a Christian. You're going to have to make decisions, you know, to go to services when you don't want to, when you don't feel like it. You know, when you absolutely hate the preacher. I hope that's not the situation here, but I've been in places where, man, just thinking about the preacher made me sick to my stomach. Because I knew the stuff he was going to say and why he said it and, you know, whatever thing else, and I knew it was the worst stuff to be done. But hey, it was the closest church in 60 miles. What are you going to do? People are not aware of the need of the Bible study to prepare for the next issue coming down the road. And there's always a next issue. You know, it's surprising as you read the time of the Reformation movement, of the issues they had to deal with, trying to get people out of the old man-made religions and into, you know, just back to first century Christianity. You know, a lot of those issues that they dealt with and got through crop up every 10, 20 years. Same arguments are needed in order to get them back. And there's always something just looming across the horizon. It's not humanism or evolution or Islam or something like that. There's always something coming down the pike that you're going to have to deal with. Are you ready to deal with it? Because it's going to reach into your life. And if you haven't prepared yourself and those around you, boy, you're going to have a severe crisis. People do not want to hear about the troubles and issues and problems, thinking that ignoring them will make them go away. Give examples of isolation, you know, of America during World War II, run out of time. It underestimated the force and appetite of evil. Only resistance and war could win over such struggles. I mean, finally gets to a point where we haven't dealt with things on a spiritual level, in a mental level, we have to reduce the physical. Those pointed times of war that God sets us into. Mainly because we didn't do our job. Some are isolationists when it comes to church issues. We are content to let the devil convince us that he will only bother churches in a far place and not churches at home. Edmund Burke's got a quotation, all it takes for evil, you know, to increase is for good men to do nothing. Okay? He was a prophet. He was trying to warn the French exactly which way their conduct was taking them. When the French Revolution hit, you wouldn't believe the inhumanity to man. The lack of justice, the sheer barbarism. And he warned them. They didn't listen. Some believe that preachers are just crying wolf when issues arise and try to inform people. Or, you know, it's boring or something like else. You know, get us some of that. What do you think we're up here for? If my job was just to tell you what you want to hear, I'm not doing my job. If I'm not up here because I care for your soul, you know, I'm a failure as a preacher. So sometimes I'm going to tell you things you don't like. I'm going to try to make applications. I try to do the research to be a little bit of a prophet to see what's coming and to prepare you for it. If it bores you or bothers you or whatever, okay, rethink it. Please. The devil is real, the danger is present, and faith is in crisis more and more, and many are not aware of it. Many should now be teachers, and they don't prepare themselves to be that. I mean, why are a lot of churches that are mentioned in the New Testament no longer around? You know, people think, well, there's some good, solid Christians in the church, you know, they'll handle it. Don't count on it. Don't count on it. I'll tell you how easy it is for some, you know, the good solid ones to suddenly find, well, I got to go back home, I got to move to someplace else, you know, the job's carrying me out. And suddenly you find you're it. You're the one that's going to have to defend the church. You're the one that may go someplace else and have to start one. Are you prepared to do it? I mean, it is mostly the most important thing in this world, putting God's kingdom first. Are you prepared to, you know, either build it up where you are or to build it from scratch where you're going? Paul prepared Timothy for these crises. That's what we're looking at. And this needs to be done today. You know, if you think we're not in crisis right now, man, you're sleeping through the commercials. You know, this country has never been more in a crisis of faith than right now. The church has never been more in a crisis of faith than right now. Except maybe New Testament times. Now is the time to make those little decisions, to start building yourself up, to start building others up, and start making the church as strong as it can be. Conclusion. How will you know it without reading God's Word? If you don't understand the past or whatever, you can't recognize things that are problems. I mean, we've talked about, you know, young people when they go, yeah, you're trying to tell them not to do something, you go, I don't see anything wrong with it. Of course they don't. Just as you won't see anything wrong with it if you don't know the difference between good and evil, right and wrong. Because you never read the Word of God to find out. People, they get married and they get all sorts of problems develop and they go, yeah, I don't, what can I do about it? And a lot of times, nothing. You've already made commitments. You've taken vows. Even if now you want to serve God, maybe your mate doesn't. You got to live with it. How will you know if you are inattentive to gospel preaching? Well, the snores would help. But, you know, how will you know if it's not really not sinking in? How will you know if you become dull of hearing? Well, how fired up are you? How enthusiastic are you? I mean, if you sit here, have you listened to the words of the Psalms? Recall any of them? Did you listen to anything somebody said in the prayers? Did you think about anything when, you know, when Wes was up here doing the Lord's Supper? Okay, if it's just a drone and noise, a white noise, and then finally, you know, right now it should be over with, okay, you're in a crisis of faith. Well, you be ready when the critical tests come? Should be ready right now. Yeah. Could we give you a test about what your knowledge of the Bible or the things you've done for God this week? What would your answers be? You know, a lot of blanks. One indication is how you respond to the Lord's invitation for salvation. How often have you sat there and never decided, I'm going to do what God wants me to do? Okay. Now, as we said, there should have been a lot of decisions made up to that point. Okay. And there has been. You've either decided through all the things that you've heard, all the things you said, that it's not important. You've decided there's something, you know, better for life, you know, than serving God. Or you've made those decisions that what you're looking at is the most critical thing in this life, that it's absolutely necessary beyond all of the things, and you've got to get right with God this very moment. Which is it? In case you've made the latter decision, the invitation's extended. Won't you come as we stand to sing?